This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Operator Down by Brad Taylor. Read to you by Rich Orlow and Henry Strozier. To Ben Sevier, foreseeing the potential in an unknown. To put on the garment of legitimacy is the first aim of every coup. Barbara Tuchman.
1. Being a spy is a lot like being a bank robber. In espionage, as in crime, it's always the little things that get you. You can plan for an entire operation, allowing for one contingency after another, foreseeing when and where things might go wrong. But you inevitably miss the little things. A drop of sweat on a doorknob. Drywall shavings left behind after the installation of a bug, a nick from a tension wrench, and the brass plate of a lock. Small things with huge impacts. In this case, the little thing happened before Aaron Bergman had even left Israel, when a travel voucher routed through Mossad headquarters included a man who had been specifically excluded from the mission read-on, for a specific reason. And that little thing would prove devastating for Aaron and his neophyte apprentice. Casually tapping the tablet in front of him, Aaron said, "Alex, turn just a tad bit to the right. I'm missing the man on the left." Across the table from him, Alexandra Levy shifted slightly, her face aglow. She said, "This is so exciting, straight out of a James Bond movie." He chuckled, then said, "Right there. Good." He hit record on the tablet. Alex stiffened a little bit, as if she were posing for a photographer, holding her angle. She whispered, "That thing will really read their lips? Tell us what they're saying?" Aaron said, "Yep. If you can keep the camera on them. But don't look so rigid. Relax a little. I'll tell you if it shifts off." Aaron continued manipulating a piece of software in his tablet, something that was highly classified and usually reserved for active Mossad agents. A simple button camera in Alexandra's blouse was tied by Bluetooth to his tablet and seemed to be out of a 007 movie, but in truth, both were commercially available to anyone who wanted them. The secret was the software churning through what the camera sent it. Artificial intelligence for facial recognition had grown by leaps and bounds in recent years, and the Mossad had taken that in a different direction, focusing on the spoken word. They'd replicated the human act of lip reading in the cyber world, designing a software suite that could decipher what was being said without hearing sound. Alex relaxed her body a bit, contrition floating across her face. "Sorry, this isn't my expertise. You should be doing the camera work." He laid the tablet on the table and took a sip of beer, saying, "You're doing fine. This beats working in the Diamond Exchange, right? Keep up the talent, and I might recruit you for my firm." She grinned and said, "No, no, this is enough excitement. I enjoy being able to help. I've never even been to Africa, but I'll stick with my boring job." There was no fear in the statement, no realization of the risk. It was like she thought they were executing a high school senior prank. She had no idea of the threat level. That would come later. She glanced over the balcony toward their target and said, "Besides, I don't think your partner would agree to that. I think she hates me." Three people sat at the table they were filming, two white and one black. Their target was a man of about 35, and unlike the rest of the patrons in the restaurant, he was dressed in a suit, as if he was still working in his office in Israel. The other white man looked like he was about to head out on a safari, wearing cargo pants and a shirt that had more pockets than a photographer's vest. He had shaggy blonde hair, ice blue eyes, and a feral quality. Aaron had seen his type plenty of times before, but only in war zones. It intrigued him. The final man was tall, with a thin mustache and coal-black skin. He was dressed like a local, but didn't act like one. Ramrod straight, he showed not a whit of humor. Had they held the meeting at a cafe in downtown Johannesburg, where the target was staying, they would have attracted attention by their very disparate appearances, but they didn't hear. Which explained why Aaron's target had chosen this restaurant. The one thing remaining was to find out why the meeting was occurring. The only man Aaron recognized was the one the Mossad had asked him to track, an employee of a diamond broker in Tel Aviv. The other two were a mystery, but he'd know about them soon enough, when they reviewed the footage later. The primary problem with the lip-reading software was choosing a language. Try to lip-read German when the target was speaking Chinese, and you'd get gibberish. Here, in the township of Soweto, just outside the city center of Johannesburg, South Africa, he was sure they were speaking English. There was no way the black man spoke Hebrew, and he would be astounded if his target from Israel spoke something like Swahili or Afrikaans. No, they'd be speaking English, and the fact that his method of recording the conversation came through in visual rather than auditory form was a plus in the current environment. The outdoor balcony they were on belonged to a restaurant called Sakumzi, as did the patio holding the target's table. Just a stone's throw from the historical houses of Nelson Mandela and Bishop Tutu, in the section of Soweto known as Orlando West, the restaurant hosted a smorgasbord of local food and native performers, and was a permanent stop for tour groups, large and small, traveling to see the ghetto made famous in the uprising against apartheid. Because of it, there was a constant drumbeat of laughter and clapping, something that had no effect on the lip-reading software. As long as Aaron could keep a line of sight with whoever was talking. Aaron focused on the computer, tapping icons and ensuring three computer-generated squares remained over the men's mouths. He said, "Position is good. Keep that." When he hadn't responded to Alex's statement, she repeated, "Your partner doesn't care for me at all. I thought she was going to throw me out of your house." Aaron looked up from the tablet and said, "Shoshana? She doesn't hate you. She's just mad because I brought you instead of her. She was aggravated at me for the decision. It's nothing personal." Making sure not to disrupt the camera angle, she said, "I don't think so. When you left the room, she was a little scary." Aaron laughed and returned to the tablet, offhandedly saying, "You need to get to know her. She's not all knives and death threats. She just acts that way. She understands that she didn't have the knowledge base for this mission. When we fly back, I'll take you to dinner. The three of us." Alex smiled and said, "I'd like that. I think she thought..." Aaron looked up from the tablet and said, "Thought what?" "That we... I mean, you and me might..." Aaron scoffed and said, "You're 20 years younger than me." She said, "Yeah, but it was the Mossad that asked me. You asked me. I mean, they wouldn't do that unless it was for a reason." Aaron realized she thought she really was in a movie, and that she was hitting on him. A 20-something Sabra who worked inside the Israeli Diamond Exchange, she was no doubt attractive, with brown hair, brown eyes, liquid skin, and a quiet intelligence surrounded by an innocence he no longer possessed. He would have hunted her like a wolf a decade ago, but no longer. She deserved to live in her innocence. His entire existence was ensuring people like her could do so. He decided to put an end to the fantasy. "Alex, I picked you because you understand the diamond market. Yes, you're attractive, which meant I could use you to blend in. But I need your knowledge. Period. You watch the tape. You tell me what they're talking about within the diamond world. and I write an assessment. That's it. This isn't a complex thing. We're not here to save Israel from Blofeld. We're here to save Israel from embarrassment. That's all. It's a simple mission. Turning red, she tilted forward and whispered, "What does that mean? I wasn't suggesting anything." He said, "You're screwing with the camera angle. Lean back." The target at the table answered a cell phone. Aaron said, "Shit. Lean back, now." Alex did so abruptly, causing the camera to sway wildly. Aaron said, "Stay still." The man turned away from them, still on the phone. Aaron said, "We need to move. You need to move. Stand up and go to the bathroom. Walk by the table and get me a shot of his face as long as you can. Stop and ask the table for directions, but not to him. Let him keep talking on the phone." Hesitantly, Alex stood. More forcefully than he wanted to, Aaron said, "Go." She did, sidling between the throngs of tour bus patrons and locals, threading between the tables and down the stairs, the picture on Aaron's tablet jumping left and right. She reached the patio, and it stabilized. She walked toward the restrooms, then stopped at the table, asking directions. He recorded about a 15-second snippet of the phone conversation, unsure if the software would be able to utilize the footage, because the target's face was partially obscured by his smartphone. He glanced over the balcony to see the interaction, and she broke contact, doing a passable job of being a tourist. He saw no outward interest in the interruption. Aaron ignored the rest of the feed, wondering if Alex would be smart enough to cut it off if she really chose to use the bathroom. She did, or maybe the Bluetooth simply lost contact because of distance. He grinned and took a sip of his beer, surreptitiously giving the target table a side eye. The Israeli was asking a waitress for the check. Aaron immediately picked up his phone and called Alex, telling her to return. The man tossed some rand on the table, preparing to leave, and he saw her coming across the patio. She mounted the stairs to the balcony, and he stood, saying, "Hopefully they take the same car. If they split up, we'll stick to the target." Hidden by the balcony railing, they let the group exit the restaurant, then followed, getting to the parking lot just as they were loading a single car. A part of him spiked at the action, since they had arrived in two separate cars. He should have listened to his sixth sense. Lulled by the minimal threat of his mission, he thought he had his bases covered, but he had forgotten a hard truth he'd learned in the past. In warfare, the enemy gets a vote.
2. As we crossed the lobby to the Las Vegas Venetian Casino, another gaggle of bearded men went by, all wearing cargo pants and baseball caps with Velcro patches. Half of them toted some form of corduroy nylon backpack, which also sported a variety of gun porn patches, depicting things like ISIS Hunter or a Punisher skull. I said, "I have never seen this many super commando operators in one place in my life." Knuckles laughed and said, "Yeah, this event brings them out of the woodwork, no doubt. But make no mistake, the real deal's running around in here as well. In fact, keep your eyes peeled. The odds of us running into someone we know are pretty high, so be prepared to run the cover story." Working in cover was the worst when you did it in an area where the locals potentially knew you. Whenever that happened, the nastiest thing that could occur, besides getting your fingernails pulled out by the enemy, was running into someone who knew who you were in real life. It was the surest way to blow the hell out of what you were pretending. An FBI agent infiltrating an outlaw motorcycle gang would be in dire straits if he bumped into a friend from law school. In this case, Knuckles was still active duty Navy, and I was retired Army. In the world of the task force, when we were out in the Badlands earning our ISIS Hunter patches for real, he was a civilian employee of my company. But if another SEAL from his past saw him here, they'd know that was bullshit. So we'd created a story that was plausible should that happen to either of us. It was my first trip to the fabled SHOT Show in Las Vegas, the largest gun show on Earth. And the interior of the Sands Convention Center was literally stuffed with booth after booth selling various weapons, accessories, and outdoor gear. It was mecca to people like me, and the task force sent a contingent every year to prowl the halls looking for anything new that we could incorporate into our mission. Back when I was on active duty, as the team leader, I'd always let a junior member of the team make the trip, and Knuckles, my 2IC, had been a few times before. Given how he was dressed, I was surprised they let him in. In contrast to the bearded ones, he looked like he had come to protest the convention, with his long hippie hair, Che Guevara t-shirt, and lack of any tacti-cool paraphernalia.
He was even wearing a necklace with a bronze peace sign the size of a 50-cent piece, either as irony or as a challenge.
With him it was hard to tell, but if someone took it as a challenge, they'd be sorely wishing they hadn't. Unlike a lot of the posers at the convention, he was most definitely an operator. While the trip was a little bit of a boondoggle, we did have a specific mission. We'd just come from a booth manned by a company called Zev Technologies, a maker of high-end aftermarket components and custom frame-slash-slide work for Glock pistols, and had sealed a deal to test some pistols for our specific applications. Although we already had our own armorer support that we used to hone our combat weapons, Kurt Hale, the commander of the task force, was wondering if we weren't just reinventing the wheel, and wanted to see if it would be better to simply farm out the work. After talking to Zev, I was beginning to believe he was right. Only our wheels were something from a Conestoga wagon, while Zev was racing around on run flats. We pushed through the crowd and entered the cavernous Venetian casino, working our way to Las Vegas Boulevard. We exited into the sunshine, leaving the commandos and gamblers, only to be hit by Guatemalan refugees trying to hand me cards with hookers offering their services. One of the strangest things about Vegas. Knuckles said, "What did you think?" "Seriously? I think we should have flown here with the entire team's Glocks. No question they can do better than our internal armors. Nothing against them. But did you work the one they had on display? Better trigger than ours by far." Knuckles took a left toward Caesar's Palace, passing the gigantic Venetian Hotel, saying, "So forget about any other vendors?" He had a point. While we didn't fall under any official DOD rules about contracts, it would be stupid to latch on to the first one we found. We had a list of potential companies that could meet our goals, and it wouldn't be right not to at least check them out. But I was pretty sure where I would end up on my recommendation to Kurt. I said, "Nah, we should hit him up as well. But we only get 2 days out here, and I want some Vegas time. I'll send Retro and Jennifer to go hunt them down." "Retro isn't gonna like that, and Jennifer's not exactly an expert." Retro had been a teammate of mine since Jesus was wearing diapers. But all things come to a close sooner or later. He was set to retire from the military at the end of the month, and had truly come out here for vacation. Kurt knew he wasn't needed, but had let him come along as a little retirement gift. Unbeknownst to me, in all our time together, he absolutely loved playing craps, and his wife frowned on gambling. I learned he had planned on spending his entire time in the casinos, betting away his per diem like a drunken sailor. As we were planning to leave for the trip, he begged to come along, getting a seat through Kurt, then had turned around and told his wife he was desperately needed for national security, which she bought. As they say, what happens in Vegas? I said, "It's not going to kill him to take a break for a few hours, and as far as Jennifer goes, she could learn something." Jennifer was my partner in Grolia Recovery Services, our company, and outside of some serious weapons training I'd given her, had no military experience. She wasn't qualified to judge whether a vendor was worthy and wasn't needed on this trip either. But I'd paid for her to come along out of my own pocket because, well, she was a partner in more ways than one. She planned on spending her time at the pool, or if the weather was too cold, in the spa. I felt my phone vibrate and saw it was her. I said, "Speak of the devil." I answered, "Hey, we're on Vegas Boulevard headed home. What's up?"
"Kurt wants to talk on the VPN secure."
"About what?"
apparently about a mission in Vegas.
3. Aaron Bergman left the parking lot of the Sakumzee restaurant, keeping a few cars between him and his target, blending in with the traffic on Vilakazi Street. In short order, they had left what was sarcastically called by the locals the Beverly Hills of Soweto, crossing out of the Orlando West neighborhood and into Orlando East. Making sure he was still screened from the car in front of him, he turned to Alex and said, "What's the video telling us?" Alex, in the passenger seat, said, "It's got nothing about diamonds or the diamond exchange. They're talking about weapons. The black man is being called a general, and he's asking the blonde guy how many soldiers he has. Our target's only contribution is saying that money is no object." She looked at him and said, "What's going on? This isn't about blood diamonds. It's not about embarrassment to Israel or the diamond exchange." They entered a single-track road leading to two giant power plant towers, looking like they belonged in a nuclear facility. Only they were now painted with multicolored graffiti and artwork. "Why would they be coming here?" He said, "Get off the video. Google this place. What's here?" She did, just as they passed a sign describing the towers as a fun park, with bungee jumping, paintball, and other adventure sports. Aaron let the target car roll past the parking lot, seeing it continue on to a cluster of abandoned buildings. He pulled over to the side of the road, caught by a stream of patrons exiting the park, the sun beginning to set. He said, "Give me something. What is this place? I'm about to lose the target." Looking up from her tablet, Alex said, "It's an old coal-fired power plant. It closed in 1998. In 2008, it reopened as a bungee-jumping place called Orlando Towers. Since then, it's expanded into a bunch of different adventure events, something called SCAD Freefall, and other things." "That's no fucking help. Who owns it? Why are they here?" Alex snapped back at his tone, looked fearful, realizing she was failing in her duties. She said, "I have no idea. I don't know how to ascertain that." Aaron glanced forward and saw the car drawing away at a slow pace, passing through the remains of the power station. It pulled into an alley between two brick buildings that looked like a setting from a Saw movie, the doors hanging askew and the windows broken. He had to make a decision. He said, "Switch seats with me. Give me the tablet." They did so without opening any doors, playing a game of Twister, arms and legs flapping back and forth in an awkward dance, him keeping an eye on the car to their front. It began to disappear through the crumbling buildings, and he made a choice that would prove fateful. "Keep going. Slowly. Keep the car in sight, but don't turn down that alley. Stop before they can see us in the rearview mirror." She did so, turning on the headlights to counteract the dying sun. He immediately snapped, "Off! Off! Turn them off!" She reflexively twisted the stalk hard enough to break the plastic, shutting out the lights. She looked at him in a panic, and he patted her hand, saying, "Take a breath. We're okay." She exhaled and then inched forward, past the tourist park, and into the abandoned buildings. She leaned toward the windshield in the gathering gloom and said, "I see the car in the alley. It's pulled over next to a trash pile." He said, "Park it here, in the shadow of the buildings. Whatever they're doing, we're not going to see. We've gone far enough." He pulled out a night vision monocular and handed it to her, saying, "Keep an eye on the car. I'm going to cycle the video." He powered up the recording from the restaurant. The conversation between the men sped out at the bottom of the screen by the software package, looking like closed captioning at a sports bar. He saw that Alex was correct. The men were discussing weapons, strategy, and money. The deputy prime minister of Lesotho, Makalo Lanatha, was mentioned, Then the black man spoke, and Aaron finally had a name. Lieutenant General Jonathan Masebo, head of the Lesotho Defense Force. The readout continued, and he learned that the general was being unceremoniously fired by the prime minister and was none too pleased about it. The other Caucasian, a man called Johann, calmed him down, and the talk continued along nebulous lines about force structures and loyalties. Nothing to do with diamonds. What the hell? The phone call came, the target answering, and he fast-forwarded through Alex's short walk down the stairs. When she appeared by the target's table, he slowed the video down again, and the scrolling sentences at the bottom turned into gibberish. Confused, he punched a couple of icons on the software package, then realized what the problem was. The man wasn't speaking English. He's speaking Hebrew. Aaron glanced up from the tablet and saw that a single streetlight had come on, providing enough feeble illumination to potentially compromise them. He began manipulating the software package, saying, "How are we looking?" Alex said, "Good. I haven't seen any movement from them at all," which should have been an indicator. He loaded the Hebrew suite into the software program, saying, "Get the car turned around and out of the ring of that streetlight. We'll stay for a couple of more minutes, but this isn't worth burning ourselves. There's more going on here than just blood diamonds. I need to assess and report back for guidance." She started the vehicle, and he rewound the video feed, getting to the start of the phone conversation. She did a U-turn, parking the car on the opposite side of the street, now facing toward the exit of the dilapidated power station. He hit play, and the screen cleared. The software suite could only lip-read the target's end of the conversation, making the readout a little confusing, but eventually one sentence stitched the others together, clearing the state of play like fog hit with the morning sun. "I have a tale? From Mossad?" The text across the bottom of the screen hung still as the man on the other end of the line talked. Aaron saw the words on the tablet, not wanting to believe them. His voice grating low, he said, "Get out of here, now." Alex said, "What?" The man on the other end of the phone quit talking, and the screen spit out the target's response. "You want me to take him out? Are you sure?" In that millisecond, Aaron realized that he was no longer the hunter. He was the hunted. They had been led here for a reason. He bolted upright and saw men appearing like wraiths from the dilapidated buildings. An anthill kicked over, running toward the car. He shouted, "Get the fuck out of here!" The driver's side window was smashed. He saw Alex's head yanked out of it, a man trying to pull her from the car by her hair. He exploded forward, grabbing the man's wrist and slamming it backward into the shards of glass that remained in the window. The man screamed, releasing Alex's head. Aaron leaned over and jammed his foot on the accelerator, causing the car to burst forward. The men dove out of the way, with one flipping onto the hood. Alex shouted, and the car skipped into the curb, bounced back, and headed straight into the wall of a building. Aaron grabbed the wheel, but not soon enough. They slammed into the brick, the vehicle stopping in a grinding of metal. His door was ripped open, hands jerking all over his body, spilling him out. He hit the ground hard, felt a fist hammer his temple, and heard Alex scream again. A visceral fear flooded him, the adrenaline coursing through him in a spastic jolt. Like a father defending his family against overwhelming odds, knowing he would lose, he began doing what he knew best. He turned to fight.
4. Knuckles took a sip of his club soda and said, "This is bullshit. I should not be burning myself for this mission. We should be using Jennifer. It's easier and you know it." I kept my eye on Retro at the craps table and said, "If GRS is to remain in play for the follow-on mission, I only have two guys here who I can burn, you and Retro. You don't have to burn me. I can do the follow-on mission. Retro's the one retiring. I took a sip of my own club soda and gave him the side eye. I said, you're slated to train Carly. You want to ditch that for a simple alpha follow-on mission? Carly was a Task Force CIA case officer, who had been granted the honor of attempting to achieve operator status in the task force. Only the second female to be allowed to try after Jennifer. It was an open secret that she was dating Knuckles, and he'd fought like hell to get her a shot, with Kurt agreeing only after I'd given my concurrence. She needed some serious training to even begin to think about succeeding, and Knuckles had been detailed to conduct it. His willingness to ditch that for a simple surveillance mission with no chance of high adventure was a little strange, to say the least, especially after how hard he'd fought to give her the chance. He toyed with his napkin, then said, real-world missions take precedence, that's all. So I should burn Jennifer so you can go on a potential trip? When she has no commitments and you do? What would Carly say about that? He remained quiet, and I knew something was different. We were so close, I could read a tick of his eyebrow and learn volumes. But I wasn't sure I wanted to push. He balled up his napkin and said, you heard Kurt. This has a whole lot more behind it than a simple alpha mission. Earlier, after leaving the convention center, we'd returned to our hotel room at Caesar's Palace to hear what Kurt was thinking. Waiting on the elevator to arrive, Knuckles had broached a topic that was also on my mind. What the hell do you think this is about? We can't operate on U.S. soil. The task force was an extrajudicial force, which was a Washington, D.C. way of saying it was illegal, but it still had some rules. One of those was that we only operated overseas, hunting bad guys in bad guy lands. Home soil was the purview of the FBI and others. I said, no idea, but it does make me wonder why Kurt was fine with me coming out here with a full team when two guys would do. The bell dinged, and Knuckles said, well, this could be fun, but I'm smelling a shit sandwich like always. I chuckled and said, so working with me is always eating shit? We hit the fourth floor, and he said, pretty much. We'd entered my room to find Jennifer and Retro expectantly waiting, the laptop on the desk connected to the task force through an unbreakable VPN. Jennifer's eyes were alight, relishing a mission beyond sitting by the pool. Retro looked like he wanted to kick me. I shut the door and said, okay, before I get on, what's the deal? Retro said, the deal is Kurt wants to do some sort of surveillance mission here in Vegas, against our charter, I might add. I looked at Jennifer and she said, apparently there's an arms dealer he wants us to track, some guy who's got a booth here at SHOT. She glanced at Retro and raised an eyebrow, saying, I think it sounds fun. Retro's a little angry. He said, I'm not angry. I just think it's a little sleazy cutting this trip short for a mission that we're not even allowed to do. Which meant he was pissed. His answer brought a grin to both Knuckles and me.
Because in the 22 years he'd been running missions, he'd never cared about the rules.
I held up a hand and said, okay, okay, don't worry about your craps weekend just yet. Dial Kurt up. Let's see what this is about. We connected, waited a bit, and then Kurt Hale settled in front of the camera. He turned around to look behind him and said, close the door, George. When he returned to the screen, I saw his lips curl into a ghost of a smile. How's Vegas? I said, a little boring to tell you the truth. I understand you want to spice things up. He laughed and said, you find a vendor for the work on our pistols? Yeah, I got the one that I think we're going to end up with. But we haven't checked out the others yet. Good, don't worry about the others. Just send the information you have. What's up, sir? The camera feed disappeared, and in its place a target card appeared. A single PowerPoint slide that had the specifics on someone we were hunting. Name, Tyler Malloy. Citizenship, United States of America. Professed occupation, arms dealer. Activity. Intercepts indicate possible facilitation of weapons transfers to groups designated as foreign terrorist organizations by the Department of State. Currently attempting to gain trigger components suitable for nuclear weapons. Currently licensed in good standing with Department of State ITAR protocols. Threat low.
Authority, Alpha Only, Secondary Protocol. Next to the information on the slide was a picture of a thick-necked guy of about 28, with the ubiquitous operator beard and a pronounced Jay Leno-looking jaw. He was giving his best I'm-a-badass scowl. I said, "What's this guy's story?" The slide vanished, and Kurt reappeared on screen. He was an enlisted Marine for 4 years, one tour in Helmand. After that, he became an independent contractor for a company called Blue Spoon. He ended up in Bulgaria training a bunch of Syrian moderate rebels under the failed CIA program. While he was there, he seemed to figure out where the money was really made, which was supplying the arms for the fight instead of getting paid by the hour to train up a bunch of farmers. Blue Spoon was buying a ton of AKs and other old Soviet arms from Belarus and Bulgaria, and he spent his time there learning the trade and building personal contacts. Eventually, he went out on his own using those contacts and undercutting Blue Spoon pricing until his little company became the sole supplier. That was 3 years ago. Now he's a real player, selling everything from tanks to missile launchers. He's moved far beyond the small train and equip program for Syria. I said, "And we're tracking him because why exactly?" "The card says he's a nobody, low threat and secondary protocol. Hell, according to the Oversight Council, he's not even worth a primary mission. He's a standby target in the if we have the time category. He'll probably get arrested by the FBI for breaking ITAR if we let him run it out. Except he's apparently got some ideas about purchasing nuclear components and we don't know why. The guy is amoral with respect to buyers, and while we don't really give a shit if he sells some AKs to someone who passes them to Hezbollah, nuclear components are something else entirely." I brought up the elephant in the room. "Sir, he's an American. We're on American soil. We can't operate here. I get President Hanister loves us, but surely he didn't authorize this." Kurt vanished from the screen, and a new picture appeared. An older man in a foreign military uniform, with a receding hairline and tiny pig-like eyes. He looked like a caricature of some old Soviet propaganda poster. Kurt said, "This is Stanko Petrov, Tyler's unofficial right-hand man, formerly a colonel in the Bulgarian army from the Warsaw Pact days. He scraped by after the fall of the wall until he met Tyler. He's the man who got Tyler his start in the arms trade. He now acts as a sort of combination personal security slash personal assistant to Tyler. Everything that Tyler's planning to do goes through him, and he's Bulgarian." I smiled and said, "Ah, so, approval because we aren't officially tracking an American. We're tracking a Bulgarian. Nice. Where's his target card? What's the council's level of operational approval for him?" Kurt reappeared and said, "He doesn't have a card. Look, Pike, this guy has an iPad mini that's glued to him like a third hand. Everything Tyler does is executed through Stanko, and that iPad will have it all." I glanced back at my crew, now on unfamiliar ground. Usually it was I who was begging to break the rules. Now my commander was ordering me to do so. I wasn't sure how I felt about that. It was easy to rage against the machine when the machine kept you in check. It was something else when the machine itself began to go off the rails. I said, "Sir, are you sure about this? Did you talk to the Oversight Council?" He exhaled and said, "No, they don't care about Tyler, and truthfully, neither should we. But I've got a feeling about him. He's not a good guy. He can pull his small-time shit and stay off the radar. But he's up to something, and that something is potentially big. I don't want to react to a threat. I want to prevent it from occurring." I paused, not responding. He said, "Pike, all I want you to do is attempt to access the iPad. If you can't, you can't. Just get me details on where and when his next overseas trip is, so I can begin executing Alpha Authority against him. Let me deal with any fallout. I'm not asking you to thump him on the head. When I learned he was at the SHOT Show, it was the perfect coincidence." I considered his words. In truth, it sounded easy enough, and honestly, I could use some high adventure. If Kurt thought it was good enough, then I wouldn't question, although I'd keep the overstep in mind. Because I'd personally saved the president's life on a previous mission,
We now had his ear, which meant we'd get to do whatever we wanted with our intelligence. But cutting out the Oversight Council might not be the best thing for the nation, because it would be up to the operator on the ground to determine what was right in the future. And I was that operator. Not liking the role reversal, I relented with a caveat. Okay, but we get the follow-on mission. Now it was his turn to pause. He said,
"You guys are off cycle. You don't even have a team. Retro's retiring, Veep's attending SODIC, and Knuckles is on a training billet for Carly."
I said, "They don't call it SOTIC anymore. It's just the SF sniper course now."
Kurt said, "Whatever. I'm sure that was a bullet on some officer's OER.
I said, "What's Blood doing?"
"Some liaison work with OGA.
"Well, there you go. That's my team." 5. I watched Retro throw the dice, holding a spit cup and arranging a huge dip of Copenhagen in his mouth with his tongue. I said, "At least he's getting in his craps time. He can't bitch about the mission now." Knuckles said nothing. I looked at him and poked the blister. "What's going on with you and Carly?" He said,
"Nothing. I should be going on this mission. It never left me behind."
I looked him in the eye, the mission taking a back seat. He turned away. I said, "You've never shirked on a commitment before. Remember that time in Bosnia, when you were supposed to leave, but you refused because you feared for a source of ours? The council ordered you out and you stayed. You have a commitment to Carly. What's changed?" He bluntly said,
"We broke up."
I leaned back, taking that in. He'd spent so much energy getting her a shot at selection because of their relationship, and now they didn't have one. I knew it had to hurt. I said, "Does she still want to do it?" Glumly, he nodded.
"Yeah, she does."
"What was the breakup? Something bad?"
"No, we just sort of decided. It wasn't bad."
I looked at Jennifer across the hall, waiting near the reception counter for our trigger. She was reading a magazine, oblivious to the conversation. I said, "You can't do that, Knuckles. You made a promise. Carly deserves it. She bled for us." He looked up, and I saw that he knew I was right. He said,
"Yeah, I get it. You think I should train her, knowing what you know about her? You had questions before."
I laughed and said, "So now you're questioning her capability because you're no longer in the sack with her? You brought this on yourself, and yes, I think she's capable. Any team showing an interest in her?" Kurt had already decided that, if Carly succeeded, she wouldn't be coming to my team. For one, there was no reason to stack a single team with the unique capabilities a female might bring. For another, he wasn't keen on the fraternization. He allowed it with Jennifer and me because we were civilians, and he honestly couldn't do anything about it. Knuckles being active duty Navy was a different story.
"Yeah, Johnny's team. Axe likes her. He's seen Jennifer and wants that in the mix. But she's not Jennifer.
Nobody is Jennifer. Train her ass to the best of your ability. This is just an alpha mission. If you don't do it, Jennifer will lose trust in you, and that means something on this team." He nodded reluctantly, and my earpiece came alive with Retro's voice. "How long can I play? I'm pretty sure I've destroyed every key card within 10 feet of me." Retro had a device that generated an enormous electromagnetic field around him. In essence, he was carrying a giant magnet in his pocket, which would wipe any hotel key that came within his web. 2 feet to the right of him was the Bulgarian, Stanko, his iPad mini on the rail as he gambled. Kurt had given us what he knew about the Bulgarian, most of which was useless, but one tidbit stood out. Like Retro, he was fond of playing craps. It had been a simple matter to find Tyler's booth, learning his company had the unimaginative name Parabellum, and follow Stanko for the short time it took him to begin gambling. From there, I set my plan in motion, with Retro now on board when he learned all he had to do was roll the dice. Well, until he had to do something embarrassing, which was why he was calling. I said, "Next time you get the dice, play to your heart's content until then." I heard, "That's 3 players. Is the task force going to pay for the bets?" "No fucking way. Force it now if you want." I heard, I knew you were too cheap. I should have left this team a long time ago. I laughed and said, I thought you were winning. I was, not now. 7 minutes later, through Retro's microphone, I heard, new shooter, new shooter. Then Retro himself saying, okay, here you go. One roll and then he's off to his room. Off the net, I said, Knuckles, get ready. You sure about this? When I get in the elevator with him, I'm done forever. Yeah, I know, sorry. But you're doing your part for America. He scowled. We both looked at Retro's table. He rolled once, got what he wanted, and jumped up and down, spilling his vile cup of spit onto Stanko's shirt. Immediately there was an altercation, with shouting and threats. Retro handled it well, backing off and offering chips as a placating measure. Stanko took them, then stalked off, heading to the elevator. I looked at Knuckles and said, showtime. He nodded and left, walking behind Stanko. Ordinarily, we could have used the task force to figure out this guy's room, a seamless little hack that would prevent the ridiculous play I had just put in motion. In this case, because the entire mission wasn't sanctioned by the Oversight Council, Kurt had refused to give me the assets I'd need to do that, stating that I had my team and that was it. I'd been aggravated about that, but knew better than to push. I either accepted the mission or I didn't. We just needed to find another way to determine his room, and the easiest way was to get him to go there, so we could follow him. I watched Knuckles get in the elevator with Stanko, the only two to do so, and knew Knuckles was pissed. No way would he be able to do anything against this target again, not after riding up an elevator with him. I remained still, sipping my club soda and waiting on the call. It came in 2 minutes. Passed by him, he's in room 703. A minute later, his key card failed. He's on the way back down. I said, Roger that. Jennifer, you got the ball. Give us the time hack. She said, Roger all. Retro came over to my table and said, you done with me? I'd like to get back some of what I lost in the name of the task force. Yeah, I'm done until tonight. I'll need you then. Retro walked and talked like a Neanderthal, but underneath he was a little bit of a computer geek. Honestly, beyond the loss of his friendship, that was going to be the biggest blow to my team. When he was gone, I'd have to find a replacement on the tech side. But I already had an idea about who that would be, the millennial currently in SF sniper school. I said, you sure that gadget you brought will work? Retro had given Knuckles what looked like a standard iPad charging cord, one with the small brick at the end. Instead of Apple-approved electronics, inside the brick was a man-in-the-middle device that would allow us to digitally drain everything in the iPad through its lightning port. When Stanko plugged it into charge, we'd start sucking it dry. He said, yeah, it'll work. I tested it on my own iPad. It's set for the Venetian Wi-Fi network, and I can access the website that downloads the data from anywhere. Jennifer came on the net.
Ivan's at reception.
We always gave targets a nickname, just to keep them straight in case there was more than one, because using real names on an open net was a non-starter. Ivan seemed to fit here. I said, Roger. Break, break. Knuckles, you in the room?
Yeah, I am, but we've got a problem.
He's got the iPad cord going straight into a USB outlet from the hotel. There's a bank of them on the desk. He's not using the AC adapter. Retro said, he'll have to use it sooner or later. We don't get the info right now. We'll get it eventually. I said, it'll join any Wi-Fi hotspot? Retro sagged back, realizing his mistake. He said, no. Not if it's password protected. That needs to be loaded in advance. Jennifer came on.
He's done. He's got his new key card.
Shit. Knuckles, Knuckles, abort. Get out. We need to regroup on a different course of action. Retro stood up saying, well, that was worth it. Can I get back to the table? I rubbed my forehead and said, yeah, we're done here. I watched Ivan return to the elevator, still wiping a napkin on Retro's stain, and called Knuckles. He's on the way up. You clear? No, I'm taking a look around. The desk has some paperwork on it. Abort. I don't want to risk him knowing we were in there. This is low-hanging fruit. We'll try something else tomorrow. I heard nothing prompting me to say, Knuckles, you copy? He came back. We won't be trying anything tomorrow. I have a paper itinerary here for a flight. He's headed out of town.
Where?
Tel Aviv, Israel.
What time is the flight?
He's leaving Las Vegas in the morning, and Tyler Malloy is on the same itinerary. I'm out of the room.
The first thing that popped into my mind was, mission accomplished. Jennifer came on.
Tel Aviv? What's there?
Knuckles said, Shoshana for one. Now I'm glad I'm no good for future work.
6. Aaron Bergman's inner being felt the light begin to coalesce around him, the kaleidoscope of insane nightmares receding into the darkness. Slowly, his brain gained traction, like a man at the bottom of a lake, looking up at the illumination from the surface, the image blurred, but better than the darkness. His conscious mind swam, getting closer and closer, until instinct took over, and he willed himself to stop just below the surface. He cracked his eyes open slightly, hearing talking nearby. He found he was flex-tied to a chair, which in turn was bolted to the floor. He felt a wave of nausea, and fought through to understand where he was without allowing those who held him to realize he was awake. And then he remembered. There had been 6 men, all African natives, and they had attacked with wild abandon. He remembered shattering the jaw of the first, then pulling Alex free. Alexandra, where was she? Only to be attacked by another. He had been clobbered in the back of the skull with something hard, taking him to his knees, and had covered his head. He remembered the man to the right driving a boot into his face, and him catching it, then launching upright, holding the foot. He twisted, causing the man's leg to contort around the knee, and he slammed his elbow down into the tangle of nerves embedded in the man's thigh, then flipped him on his back. Panting, he whirled, seeing Alex cowering next to the wrecked vehicle. He screamed, "Run! Run now!" He saw her take off down the dilapidated brick walkway, then turned back to the fight, thinking one thing. Hold them off. Focus on me. Give her the time. 4 men came at him, unskilled in fighting, but the odds alone guaranteed failure. Remarkably, they didn't resort to knives or other weapons, attempting to subdue him through blunt force, and he realized he was the prize, which gave him an advantage, as he had no such restraint. 1 man charged him, swinging his arms and bellowing. Aaron rotated, punching the man in the head as he came by, then trapping his elbow and whirling him in a tight circle, using his energy to fling him back into the others, breaking through the pileup. He leapt over the roof of the wrecked vehicle, running to the nearest door of the dilapidated building. He kicked it open, entered, then rotated around, using the door frame as a funnel to prevent all 4 from attacking him at the same time. They remained on the other side, confused at his tactic, unsure of who was going to be the first in. Aaron's only thought was that the longer he held their attention, the farther away Alex could get. The biggest one decided to penetrate and came in like a bull. Aaron waited until he was past the doorframe, then launched at him, using his skill in Krav Maga. He hammered the man up close with his elbows, tearing skin in a flurry of blows, finishing by slamming the man's head into the doorframe and dropping him in the narrow space. 1 more obstacle to reach him. Breathing heavily, he watched the men outside, now pacing and cursing. For the first time, he looked for escape behind him, seeing a factory of decrepit equipment and floorboards soiled from the homeless. He faced a choice. If he turned to run, he'd allow them through his protective channel without knowing if he could get out. If he didn't, they'd eventually find a way in behind him. They had learned from the big man. They wouldn't make that mistake again, and he was sure they were looking to penetrate the building in other ways. They knew the terrain, and he did not. He heard glass break to his left, beyond the room he was in, and realized they were coming. He decided on a feint. He ran away from the doorway, apparently showing panic and giving the men outside a reason to attack. He button-hooked to the left in the gloom, watching them pour in, trying to find him, silhouetted by the light from the door. He waited until they passed, and then ran out the door behind them, hitting the street at full speed. He sprinted toward the tourist area of the Orlando Towers, seeing the remaining crowds still trickling to the parking lot. He felt hope, even as he heard the men spill out behind him. He knew they couldn't do anything once he was within the embrace of the tourists. He saw an end to the row of buildings and the expanse of the adventure playground in front of him, and redoubled his efforts. Sprinting forward with renewed energy, prematurely going through in his mind how he would contact his neophyte assistant, he cleared the final building and was clotheslined by the forearm of the blonde man from the table meeting. He hammered the ground hard and rolled to his knees, trying to regain his lost momentum, but he couldn't. The man pushed him into the dirt with a hand on his neck and said, "Don't fight me." Aaron did anyway, although it did no good. He was immediately surrounded by the other Africans, all attacking, burying him in bodies. The blonde brought out a needle and shoved it into his thigh, saying, "Stop struggling. I have no reason to hurt you." That was the last thing he remembered. And now he was tied to a chair in a room somewhere in South Africa. Or maybe not. He heard, "What do you want to do?" Then, in a heavy native African accent, "Give him to me. I can make him disappear." Aaron recognized the next voice. It was the blonde man who'd captured him, which probably meant the African accent was the man from the tape, the one called General Masibo. The blonde said, "And the girl?" "I can make her disappear, too." Aaron mentally sagged. "So they have Alex." "How? She's Israeli, as he is he. You can't make them disappear without causing them to hunt us. You don't want to fuck with Israel, trust me." From the general, Aaron heard, "Why? Their country is no bigger than mine." "Have you never heard of the Wrath of God operations?" "No, should I have?" Aaron heard laughter, then the blonde man said, "Yes. You say their country is no bigger than yours. But when's the last time Lesotho traveled the world assassinating terrorists? Trust me, if you want to play with matches, you should at least read about a few barn fires." Aaron racked his brain, trying to find an anchor as to why he was being held, but came up short. "Lesotho? Lesotho? What do they have to do with anything?" The thick accent repeated, "Give them to me. I can make them disappear. Israel won't find them in my land." Another man began talking, using a language Aaron didn't recognize, and most certainly didn't understand. It wasn't the clicks and glottal stops of the Xhosa language, and wasn't Zulu, the predominant native language spoken in South Africa. The revelation increased his unease. The conversation stopped, and the general said, "We can get him to a secret place. We can hide him until we decide what to do. Either way, we need to get him out of Durban, out of South Africa." Durban? That was at least 6 hours by road from Johannesburg. How long had he been out? A new voice said, "What about the partner? The one the girl told us about, the one in Israel. She needs to be taken care of as well." The blonde voice said, "Yes. She will. But we can use her for leverage." Shoshana? They know about Shoshana. What has Alex told them? Before he could analyze the new information, the door to his room opened. He closed his eyes and let his head loll down. He heard, "How long are those drugs supposed to work?" "Depends. There are a lot of factors. Like if he just ate, or his muscle mass, or whether he was dehydrated, or—" "Don't give me that doctor bullshit. Give me an answer." Aaron heard the blonde man speak. He's awake. The footsteps approached, and Aaron